The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the ninth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on love, human and divine, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren.
Maurice, as I prophesied at the end of our talk last week, we have before us today the three fascinating figures of Saul and David and Jonathan. Now here is a set of love stories, because it really is a set. The relations of these three men are very complicated. It's almost a complex of love relationships. But the love relationships now have nothing but men in view. These are the loves or the friendships of men. And I don't know whether you want, in the beginning, to say anything about that special aspect of love. It has always interested me very much.
Well, there can be, in purely masculine love, jealousies and almost affinities. There can be torment in it, and I'm not speaking here of any kind of deviant or any rubbish like that that some people have rather hideously tried to inject into the story of David and Jonathan. There can be a lifelong struggle between men for the possession of each other's friendship, and the case of David and Saul particularly is one of the most unhappy in I was going to say in world literature. It goes beyond that. It has, for me and for you too, I know, become a sort of a symbol of a tormented love. David and Saul, in relation to each other, loved and, I won't say hated, but had hostilities and repellent emotions as well as deeply attractive ones.
Yes, and there's something about the whole relationship between David and Saul, or Saul and David, beginning, let's name the first king first, something about that relationship which teases us as we attempt to understand it. I think the Bible is never anywhere more subtle in its narrative portions than in this portion which deals with Saul's jealousy of David, if it's that. I think one is not quite willing to leave it with at jealousy, or Saul's anger at David. Of course it's anger, and yet it isn't simple anger. It isn't simple brute anger. And reciprocally, David's feeling towards Saul. In both cases, there is love. But David has fear of Saul, too. And David could be angry at him. I think David doesn't need to be jealous of him, but David could be angry at him, and David could be outraged by him. The relation seems to change every minute. From one verse to the next, we have a new view of it. It's like changeable silk. And I would say that I could understand very well why Robert Browning should have been moved to write that very long and very interesting poem of his that he called Saul.
Mark, have you ever considered how Saul, being the first king of the Jewish people, or the Israelites as they were then, began under a kind of cloud? You remember the speech that Samuel the prophet made to the people when they asked him for a king?
Oh, yeah.
They wanted to be like all the other peoples. Samuel made a very famous declaration to them as to what a king would be. I'd like to read that because Saul must have heard it. It was made to all the people. And he began his reign under the cloud of being that which Samuel had not wanted, and which God had finally granted, as it were, almost against the divine will. You remember, Samuel said to the people, "This will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them unto him for his chariots and to be his horsemen, and they shall run before his chariots, and he will appoint them unto him for captains of thousands, and to plow his grounds, and to reap his harvest, and he will take your daughters to be perfumers, and to be cooks, and he will take your fields, and your vineyards, and he will take the tenth of your seed, and of your vineyards, and give to his officers and to his servants, and he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your goodliest young men and your asses and put them to his work, and so on and so on. This must have been heavy in Saul's mind when he began the reign. Once he had established royal line, a second king would not be under the same handicap, would not be carrying the burden of this denunciation. So Saul began, well, as we put it in colloquial language, he began with a jinx on him.
Yes.
So that he must have been heavy-hearted when he was anointed and said to himself, so I'm the man that he's been talking about, and this is what the people will expect of me.
Yes, I am an Oriental king, because that was really what Samuel was warning the people about, wasn't it? That you want a monarch the way our neighbors do, men who will ride ahead of you in chariots with great banners flying, and who will assemble great armies and take census of them and brag about how many foot soldiers and horsemen there are, and so forth and so on. And you remember God's own doubt about this matter when Samuel first unwillingly broached it to him, because Samuel himself had not wanted to take the matter to God. Nevertheless, he did when pressed. God's own remark was, as I remember, to the effect that the people already had a king, namely himself.
Yes.
He was not only
and this was Samuel's objection. And the way God conceded to the demand, the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken unto their voice and make them a king." It's almost a grudging concession to the popular demand. It wasn't done with that, magnificent divine generosity with which he gave them the Torah.
Well, also, Maurice, it's almost as if he was saying, if you insist upon having a king, you may have one, although it can destroy you. It's as if God knew that. And in some sense, I dare say it did, because the deepest troubles of the people came after the three tolerable kings, Saul and David and Solomon, were through. After that,
a tale of continuous descent after that.
Yes.
With occasional restorations, as in the case of Josiah and others, but the kingship was not a happy episode. And Saul, being the first of them, and with this cloud hanging over him, and then this young man, who was obviously, we can glimpse from the narrative, more fitted to be a king than he, with his grace and his power and his abilities, his manifold abilities. He was a singer and a fighter and apparently an administrator too, because when Saul set him to do certain pieces of work, we read that he went in and out of the people and the people loved him. And there Saul himself deeply and one might almost say passionately attracted to him, thought to himself, there is the real king, and my own line, something like Macbeth, you know, thinking of being a king, but the line will descend through Banquo. Here he is looking at this David, can't help admiring him, being soothed by his music. So this, to use a common word, this ambivalence all through the whole of the a tempestuous relationship between them.
And of course, Maurice, there was in the beginning the rather doubtful reason that Saul had been picked by Samuel. Saul was head and shoulders taller than the other men. Now, it happens that Abraham Lincoln, who was a great president, was head and shoulders taller than most of the men about him, but that isn't why we call Lincoln the great man.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with his greatness.
It also reminds me of the sardonic or slightly ironical situation that's so often referred to. A man went out to look for his father's lost asses, sure, and he found a kingdom.
Yes.
Well, there is something already not consonant with a great destiny in that sort of accidental and trivial relationship.
Now, and as I say, there is something terribly touching to me about the calling of Saul to this great office. Of course, to his surprise, because he was just a farmer, wasn't he? As you say, he was a man who on that day was out looking for his father's lost she-asses. Here he was suddenly called to this office, which I dare say he didn't understand. And the first few trials of him by Samuel, who as judge remained somehow or other still over the king, if that's possible, just as a counselor can be over a king, or a constitution can be over a king, the first trials of Saul by Samuel didn't turn out well. Saul was always making blunders. He was always misunderstanding. In that famous case, you know, where he was to wait until Samuel came to perform a certain sacrifice, Samuel said, "I shall be there at a certain time." Well, at that particular moment, Samuel had not appeared, and Saul said the sacrifice must be performed, and he performed it. Then Samuel came and said, "But you didn't wait. I was to perform the sacrifice. You shall be punished for this."
It seems terribly unjust. There's a disproportion about it. But it fits in with the unhappiness of all his career. It fits in also with his vacillating character. There was something vacillating about him. There was something different between him and David. David, too, had divine revelations. You remember, on two occasions, Saul was drawn into the prophetic frenzy, and on two occasions, we find that that phrase, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" almost derisive used about him.
Yes.
But when David danced before the ark, there was something about it very exalted and inspiring. But coming back to the relationship between the two men, apart from the happiness and the relief that Saul got from David's playing, you remember that on two occasions, even while David was playing to him, Saul, in a revulsion or in a sudden convulsive rising up of his hatred, tried to kill him.
Yeah, and we're not to understand, and we're not to understand at all, are we, that Saul had asked David to come there and play for him just so he could have him have him as a target.
No. And the deep love that he had for David comes out in two passages that have always moved me very much. On two occasions, David, who was being hunted by Saul during a great part of his life, on two occasions, David spared Saul's life and was able to reproach the king with the sin of his enmity. And on both occasions, Saul expressed himself with such tenderness for him. The first time, David asked him, "Why do you pursue me?" He says, why do you come forth against me? And I could have killed you, but my hand shall not be upon thee. And it came to pass, when David had made an end of speaking these words unto Saul, that Saul said, "Is this thy voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept, and he said to David, "Thou art more righteous than I, for thou hast rendered unto me good, whereas I have rendered unto thee evil. And thou hast declared this day how thou hast dealt with me." And so on. The second occasion, again, Saul said to David in similar circumstances, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my life was precious in thine eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool and erred exceedingly." He said this, but David didn't return to him. He knew that the situation between them was hopeless, and it must have been aggravated, too, by the relationship of the children to Saul. Michal, the daughter of Saul, who rose against her father and saved the life of David. And then Jonathan, completely bound, his soul knitted to the soul of David. And Saul having to reflect that my own son doesn't want the line to continue through him. A very bitter relationship.
Yes, I should say that the seeds of jealousy were very deeply planted in the soul of Saul. And they grew. And the reason that the story moves me so much is that it's so easy to understand why they might grow. But the thing that moves me most of all is the fact that Saul continues to love David and continues to admire his genius, even though he knows that he is losing everything, will lose everything to David in the end. You see, if Saul had been some kind of brute, if he'd been nothing but a man head and shoulders taller than others, if he'd been nothing but a gigantic Israelite.
Israelite Goliath.
Yes, sort of Goliath. If he had been nothing but that, if he had been nothing but ambitious, nothing but arrogant, he wouldn't have been able to say these piercingly tender things that you have just now quoted. He wouldn't have been able to admit to himself that he had been evil, whereas David had been good. No, there is a mixture in him at all times, and you never know which feeling is going to be uppermost, what he's going to remember, or what he's going to forget. I think that is why the story is so great. It is like all great love stories, for that matter, because all great love stories, surely are all great loves, go in and out of understanding and misunderstanding.
Yes, but the exception that I would make to that is the relationship between David and Jonathan. There doesn't seem to have been a single blemish, a single retreat from the intimacy and the love that they enjoyed. And what is peculiarly striking about that relationship, and must have been at moments gall to the father, is the suddenness of it. There's such a thing, I suppose, as sudden friendship, as there is a friendship at first sight, as there is a love at first sight.
Oh, by all means.
And it wasn't perhaps at first sight that Jonathan loved David, but we read that immediately after the killing of Goliath by David, and when David had told Saul who he was, you remember Saul in one of his dreadful fits of amnesia, couldn't identify him, told him who he was. It came to pass that when David had made an end of speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul, and Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, even to his sword and to his own bow and to his girdle. If Saul wasn't present at that moment, and he may have been, it was certainly told him how his own son had abdicated in advance his heirship and had passed it on to David. And by the way, here is an interesting instance of matters we discussed weeks ago. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Here is a case where thou shalt love thy neighbor or whoever it is as yourself. Here is an instance where this is pure. We're going to talk about cases where it was impure. But here is a love that is steadfast, never wavers, and from the beginning you have the feeling that no shadow will ever come between them.
Now, you see, I was about to say, Maurice, that one thing that favored the purity of the love of these two men, I mean the unbreakable nature of it, was that they were contemporaries. They were both young. The relation between Saul and David was the relation between an older and a younger man, between a king, if you please, and a subject, even though an anointed subject. And that meant that there was a lack of equality between them, of the sort that might endanger their relation. But between David and Jonathan, who are both young, possibly exactly the same age, there was at least an equality of age. I've always remembered Aristotle's analysis of friendship when he says that it cannot be real unless the status of the two friends is the status of equality. A difference in age, difference in rank, a difference in wealth.
Yes, wealth can interfere.
Anything that gives either of the friends an advantage over the other tends to deprive the friendship of its perfection. As a matter of fact, Aristotle's analysis becomes so fine that you wonder whether two friends could ever truly exist. But David and Jonathan did. And there are those great words that David sings in his lament for, of course, both Saul and Jonathan, but particularly now Jonathan. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Wonderful was thy love to me, passing the love of women. A
yes.
Very famous phrase.
But read also, since we were talking about David's love for Saul, read also that part where he tells of Saul near the beginning of that passage.
Oh, of course. Because he loved Saul, if
deeply.
Very deeply. Well, it begins, you remember, when word comes that both are dead. Thy beauty, O Israel, upon thy high places is slain. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Let the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, neither fields of choice fruits. For there the shield of the mighty was vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, the lovely and the pleasant in their lives, even in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Jonathan upon thy high places is slain.
Yes. One would say, reading that passage, that it becomes quite credible that the greatest psalms were written by David.
Yes.
People challenge it and say that they were written much later. They may have historical arguments on their side, but they haven't got the spiritual argument on their side. I would say that here he set the pattern for threnody and praise and words that reach very deep into the heart. Jonathan has always attracted me enormously for his modesty and for his completely ungrudging surrender of the privileges he might have enjoyed. He said to David, you shall be king and I shall be your right-hand man.
Yes.
And I'm sure it wasn't out of ambition that he said, I shall be your right-hand man, your counselor. Mishneh is the Hebrew word. He meant, I want to be near you.
Yes.
Don't drive me away and you become king. And something of the sweetness of Jonathan comes through in another connection. You remember we were talking some weeks ago about the contrast between Abraham's readiness to sacrifice his son at the call of God and the what I considered, I think you did too, the brutal attitude of the father of Manlius Torquatus, who actually did slay his son.
Yes.
For a breach of discipline. Well, you remember how on a certain occasion the men of Israel who were going out to battle with the Philistines were ordered to fast. Jonathan hadn't heard about it, and with the tip of his rod he touched some honey and carried it to his lips. And this was finally revealed to Saul, and Saul, having taken that vow, was ready to sacrifice him, and the army rebelled.
Yes.
The army would not permit that to be carried out. Obviously, Jonathan must have been very deeply loved by the men. We see him also as being very valiant. It's almost, there's something in him almost of medieval knighthood.
That's right. That's a very fine image.
The touch of the chivalresque.
Yes, and you remember the episode of the arrows.
Yes.
When David shoots the arrows and Jonathan is there to see
Where they fall.
Where they fall, and he's going to report to David. It's a there you have a somehow a perfect suggestion of a communication between these two.
There's something else that has a touch of the, well, almost the romantic about it, that the friendship didn't survive into old age because Jonathan fell early, died in his youth on Mount Gilboa. Oh, let me interrupt myself. Do you know that curse that was placed by David on Mount Gilboa?
Yes.
There shall be no dew, and let there be no dew and no rain upon you, mountains of Gilboa. Actually, Mount Gilboa remained barren until, it is still barren. And at the foot of Mount Gilboa until 20 or 25 years ago, there was nothing but swamps. The whole area was blighted.
Yeah.
It was only in 1922 or 23 that young pioneers in Palestine determined to redeem the area and built two very lovely colonies at the foot of it in spite of the malarial conditions. It's as though there had been a curse placed, and perhaps that provoked some of this literature.
Maurice, let me go back to something you said earlier this hour. When you said that the friendship of David and Jonathan was, of course, a normal friendship of that great sort that can exist between men, And there's to be no nonsense spoken about it. I quite agree with you. The friendship of men can be so deep and lasting a thing that even the wife of one of the men can be jealous. Now, I have known, and I dare say you've known, of a wife who is jealous of her husband's best friend, merely because, if perhaps, he could say things to the friend that he cannot say to her, or because they like to be together in a way that, to be sure, does not mean that the husband does not like to be with the wife either. But there is something between those two men. There's some understanding between them that she does not share. This could be a bitter thing, although the wisest sort of wife is happy to have her husband possess so good a friend, I'm sure.
She may be happy that he has such a friend, at the same time suffer a little from the sense of exclusion, areas of his life to which she has no access. Let me go back to what I call that romantic notion that Jonathan had to die young. I can't imagine these two men, with David's tempestuous life afterwards, and what he had to do to certain members of the House of Saul, I can't imagine them growing old together, can you?
No.
They have to be young. This has to be, as in the case of happy loves between man and woman. Here, its perfection lies in the fact that it was never, well, if I put it rather oddly, never tainted with old age and any of the grumblings of old age.
Well, there's something like the famous friendship between Roland and Oliver. You spoke of medieval knights. There is that famous pair of friends also, you know, from the Song of Roland.
Yes.
Roland and Oliver, who were like David and Jonathan in many respects. And death came early there, too.
There were many. There was Damon and Pythias. The beauty of these friendships is that they set a pattern, and the pattern disappears. You're not told a long, long story, as you are in the case of men and women love. And what you've said about the relationship between David and Jonathan also gathers force from the fact that David was a great lover of women.
Oh, yeah.
He and not Solomon was a great lover, in spite of the Song of Songs we're going to talk about. And in fact, our next talk will be about David and his wives as a sort of offset to David and Jonathan.
Just heard The Words We Live By, the 9th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Professor Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of love, human and divine. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Next, monitor news on the hour on NBC Radio.